Welcome to Hot Wash. I'm Trudy.
And I'm Christine. We're emergency management and public health professionals.
Nerds talking about law and policy of emergencies.
Today on episode 2 of Hot Wash, we're talking emergency declarations and orders. We'll be joined by Matt Davis, a colleague and expert on state emergency response who has been tracking COVID-19 orders around the country. And we're all broadcasting from home, so please excuse our sound quality. Welcome back, everybody. We're living in some interesting times right now. I hope everyone is staying safe and sane out there. Here in Maryland, we're under a stay-at-home order, so we're all recording this remotely from our homes. And we're joined today by our fabulous colleague, Maggie Davis. Hey, Maggie, how are you?
I'm doing well. Keeping in there.
So, Maggie, can you give a little background about yourself before we get into this?
We like to find out how people ended up in this field that until like 6 weeks ago was considered a kind of unknown field to most people.
Yeah, of course. So like both of you, I also went to law school at the University of Maryland. And while there, I focused in healthcare law and policy. And then after graduation, I did some work at some other nonprofits related to different aspects of health policy, and then was offered an interesting position at the center to work directly on initially outreach with emergency preparedness, but with a lens towards public health emergency preparedness. And I initially thought it'd be interesting to learn more about public health disasters. I did a little bit of work on it during my master's program I did before law school, and did some like pandemic tabletops then. So it's a little interesting to fast forward a decade later and to have the grad school practice become real life.
Emergency declarations and emergency orders are everywhere in the news these days, of course. There's also been a lot of confusion about them. The legality of these orders, the enforceability, even really where the authority to issue these types of orders come from. I've seen some really confused conversations online, and even some incorrect or inaccurate statements by members of the media about what emergency orders are. Professor Trudy, would you mind providing a little bit of general information about emergency orders?
Sure. So with the caveat that it varies state to state, all states in the United States allow their governors through a legal framework to declare a state of emergency. And this comes from, in many states, the constitutional power of the governor, who acts as sort of the state's commander in chief. And then there are also statutory provisions that outline what those emergency declaration powers are, what those emergency declarations must include, and also how long those emergency declarations can last. And in a lot of states, there are provisions for how the state legislature can overturn those emergency declarations if they feel that they're being used improperly. And so what we are seeing right now is a lot of states' governors using those emergency declarations. Now, again, this would vary state to state, but most emergency declarations give governors a broad range of powers, which is something that makes sense in the context of a natural or man-made disaster or a public health catastrophe in order to help them respond. So one of the things that you see in a lot of statutes is the governor has the ability to suspend any rule, regulation, or statute in the state in order to help respond. Again, this makes sense, and a lot of times we see this with regulatory things, such as one of the examples that comes up a lot is road weight limits, so how much traffic and how much weight trucks can carry on certain roads. You see that being lifted in times of emergency because it's just not something we're really worried about. In this current time of COVID-19, we're seeing much broader powers being used. We're seeing issues of orders to stay at home or shelter in place. We're seeing orders to close businesses that aren't considered essential. And I know Maggie's going to talk to us more about what is essential. And we're seeing orders for quarantine and isolation, as well as some states are looking at testing and treatment and rationing supplies because we're seeing limits on personal protection equipment, and other kinds of medical supplies. Mm-hmm. And all of these fall under those broad powers that all states grant their governors in the statutory framework. So one of the questions that comes up is it constitutional? And the short answer is yes, the governor has these powers if he's doing it according to the framework that's laid out and he's not overstepping certain constitutional bounds, then that is the power that's been granted to the governor.
So sort of one that we're seeing in the news is people being arrested. People are being arrested for breaking these emergency orders. So they are enforceable in that way.
So when the governor issues orders, they are enforceable by law. And again, a lot of states lay out what that enforcement can look like. So in the state of Maryland, for example, if you disobey an order, you can be arrested or fined. You can be arrested and jailed for up to a year in some situations, and you can be fined $3,000 to $5,000, depending on the order. And whether it's actually advisable to be arresting and putting people in jail right now in a pandemic outbreak is a different question.
So you mentioned that different states do different things. And Maggie, you, in true law school form, compiled state survey on emergency orders. So tell us about that. What themes or trends are you noticing?
Yeah, this project started mostly as an exercise to wrap my own head around what was happening nationally, because there were some questions coming out like, well, what does all of this mean? And we're talking about this state by state. Someone's like, California just enacted this, or New York just enacted this, or this is happening in Ohio. And I'll say this is probably one of the first times where we have had the same disaster in every state plus the District of Columbia happening at the same time, and being able to see in real time how different states respond to essentially the same problem. And what's been interesting is really the themes that are consistent across, and then some of the kind of unique aspects of each state. So starting with some of the themes, I'd say the emergency orders really fall into three goals for these extreme powers. One, to reduce transmission rates, or what we've heard a lot about as flattening the curve. Two, to protect and increase the supply of personal protective equipment. So this includes emergency orders that have like suspended non-essential surgeries that would use N95 masks, or have really limited the private commerce of personal protective equipment. So limiting whether or not private citizens and not healthcare workers could purchase PPE. Third one is somewhat unique to this emergency, and it's a series of orders that are really aimed at preventing this public health disaster from blending into a true economic disaster for our business community. So this is where you see a lot of support on expanding unemployment benefit, on providing relief funds for small business owners or other sorts of employers that must shut down their operations in order to achieve the primary goal of reducing the transmission rate. So that's kind of the three main categories. And then what's been really interesting is the state-by-state uniqueness of it. But I will say the majority of states are using probably their most restrictive orders, which a lot of people have been talking about, these stay-at-home orders, where the governor has mandated that you should be staying in your residence unless you are leaving for an essential task, such as going to work in an essential business, or going to get supplies like groceries, or going to seek medical care. At this point, 29 states in the District of Columbia have a stay-at-home order. 7 states have a partial stay-at-home order. So that's either states like Pennsylvania, which has enacted stay-at-home orders in a county-by-county basis, not statewide, so only part of the state is under a stay-at-home order, or some states have enacted stay-at-home orders for specific populations, such as anyone over the age of 65, which is one of the groups of highest concern for this disease. But then there are 14 states that have no stay-at-home orders. But some of that is also culturally. It's not necessarily meaning that those states aren't responding with the same sense of urgency. I think it's a state recognition of a stay-at-home order isn't necessary to curb transmission rates, because the culture of their state doesn't have a lot of opportunities to congregate closely together. For example, 3 of the states that I would say in this category are North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wyoming, which are already very widespread population.
Pretty,
and so instead
out,
of
yeah.
issuing, yeah, there's a lot of space out there.
beautiful.
So instead
space.
Of issuing a stay-at-home order, they've closed non-essential businesses and closed schools, which are the main areas where people would congregate. They're seeing, you know,
there isn't a need to have that more restrictive measure to meet the goal of reducing the transmission rate.
Do you, both of you, do you think that this mixed bag approach to orders, to some of these stay-at-home orders and closing everything but essential businesses, do you think that hinders our ability as a country to effectively combat this pandemic?
Yeah, I think it is one of the benefits of how we have set up our system that each of these states are able to address this public health crisis in a way that best fits their state culture. Not every state needs the same tools and levers to address the three main concerns, which are reducing transmission, protecting and increasing the supply chain for our healthcare system, and helping to make sure that, you know, this public health disaster doesn't create long-lasting impacts to our business, mm-hmm. community, and economic future. So there are some things that states have done consistently because it's a clear step to take, such as closing the schools because public schools, there's just a lot of people congregated close together, and it's a common vector of transmission. Think of any mm-hmm. regular flu season. You could see a flu go through a school system pretty regularly. But then you get some of this flexibility where states are able to address unique kind of factors to their state culture that might be a cause mm-hmm. of transmission or a way to reduce transmission. For example, Nebraska, one of their ways that they've limited people traveling in and out of the state is they actually put limits on non-resident turkey hunting. Under
what?
Unexpected.
Yeah. So, I will say, out of this project, I think I've seen a lot of joy in some of these unique orders that tell you a little bit about a state's culture. Mm-hmm. And it really does kind of hit home that we are a collective nation of states that each bring kind of unique aspects to our country. So, mm-hmm. you got Nebraska, who's limiting non-residential turkey hunting. So, Nebraskans can still go turkey hunting. It's just non-Nebraskans.
You can't go to Nebraska to go turkey hunting.
You have states like Alaska that have enabled some of their smaller, less accessible communities more power to kind of restrict movement and manage their own kind of spread of the disease vector and protection so that they have a lot of communities that are accessible only by airplane. So they've allowed these kind of local control to manage, okay, who's going to be able to use the small commuter plane to go from that small community to maybe a larger community. Then you've got some states like Florida that yesterday banned the rental of Airbnbs. Florida mm-hmm. has a huge tourism economy, and knowing that they would like to, you know, help mitigate the flow of people, they've said, you know, a lot of people come to Florida to go see the beaches, to go on vacation. And they're like, you know, for the remaining time of the pandemic, we're just not going to let you guys come visit and rent an Airbnb. So I think this kind of unique power enables each state to address particular challenges that they would be facing that another state.
Mm-hmm. The last question I was going to ask in this section was just about essential businesses, because I think it's incredibly interesting that pre-COVID-19, I don't think people really considered our food supply and grocery stores and fast food chains and restaurants to be essential. But that's clearly what a lot of states have panic about, all this panic buying. I admit to doing some panic of my own.
Can we come to your house for toilet paper?
No. No, I
no, because you don't have any, or no, because you won't share?
No, I don't have any. We've made the transition to the European-style bidet.
Oh, very good. I think there was a question I interrupted.
I think we were talking about essential businesses.
Yes, that was it.
Yes.
Maggie bringing us back.
Okay. Have really varied on how they close essential businesses and whether they are saying they're closing all non-essential businesses or a defined list of non-essential businesses. It's probably easier to talk about the businesses that are commonly considered essential, like grocery stores and food establishments, even though a lot of the food establishments now have the restriction of either no on-premises dining or extremely limited on-premises dining across the country. But I will say, I think some people have been surprised at what is considered an essential business. You have office supply stores that are considered essential businesses, gas stations, auto repair shops. You also have some places that have their kind of brick and mortar retail stores that are still open, such as, I think there's some stories that have gone around of like GameStop remaining open, or was in one of the states where brick and mortar stores could remain open as long as they limited the number of patrons. But I'll tell you, there's probably some people in the country who think in a time of stay-at-home orders, access to new video games is essential. Definitely. Yeah.
I'm sure people are making that argument. Yes.
So it has been interesting. I will say of some common threads, the businesses that are not able to work remotely and are being consistently kind of shuttered under these orders are the ones that have close contact with other people. So things like barbershops, nail salons, tattoo parlors, massage parlors have all been, in some places, expressly told to stop work because by the function of their business, they are touching other people. So you cannot socially distance as a tattoo artist. And this kind of runs into one of the main balancing acts of this entire pandemic response, which is how do we best control the spread of the disease while not shuttering elements of our economy? How do we, in that meantime, when they need to be closed, make sure that those business owners are able to sustain, able to still pay their rent, able to pay their employees, make sure their employees have health care? And that's an area where you've actually seen the federal government step in and develop mechanisms to provide essentially bridge loans to these small businesses. We don't know yet whether what's happened so far is enough, but that's the balancing act right now of how long do we keep these drastic social distancing measures in place at the level they're at that we know are hurting certain sectors of our economy out of necessity. And how do we make sure that once the vector has passed, that we can safely have those sectors of our economy start as close to normal as they were before the outbreak.
One of the things that seems like a lot of states agree on is that liquor stores are considered essential businesses.
Yes.
I mentioned this, Maggie, because I know you have looked into this, but another business that has been somewhat controversial and then I think was just decided for us by the federal government was guns and ammunition stores and whether those were essential. I don't know if you have any insight into what the universal consensus on liquor stores is and how that happened, or if you want to talk any about that.
So Pennsylvania actually shut down their liquor stores and did not find them to be essential. So there are a few states that have not found them essential. I don't know if Pennsylvania has changed its mind since the last time I was checking their liquor store closure orders for the few states that have the order. But for the majority of states, they have declared not only that liquor stores are essential, but there are a number of states that have passed executive orders to make it easier for bars and restaurants to actually distribute liquor. Usually it's just beer and wine, so maybe not hard liquor, even though Nebraska, which I'm sorry, Nebraskans, if you're listening, because I feel like I'm picking on you as a state, passed one expressly allowing takeout cocktails.
Oh,
but that's brilliant.
Yes. So there is an emergency order out there from the great state of Nebraska that says, yes, restaurants, you can make a to-go martini now, just for the emergency.
Wow.
Sometimes you just need a martini.
It's definitely interesting on the liquor delivery side. To the other question about guns and ammunition, there isn't a lot of consensus within the state. The states haven't had a lot of emergency orders regulating gun sales or ammunition sales. The few that I've seen have really focused on making sure that social distancing measures are considered. So like one state has required that any gun or ammunition sales are by appointment only.
Okay.
So there hasn't been kind of a widespread stance on gun and ammunition sales.
So, Megan, you've mentioned a couple really interesting orders, actually, from Nebraska alone, but let's move on to pick on some other states now. What are some of the other exemplary or interesting or quirky orders that you've seen?
I would say two interesting orders that really go to an effort to curb transmission of the disease that I find really unique is some states have now required using single-use plastic bags at the grocery store. So at first glance, that might seem like a very odd order to happen, but we have heard from some public health experts as people have really focused on grocery shopping that the use of cloth bags, while better for our environment overall, does lead to a higher chance for transmitting the disease because your cloth bag is more likely to, you know, pick up germs along the way. People are unlikely to disinfect them and just general concerns that way. So some states have actually either required that grocery stores use single-use bags, which is a side note, if you have cloth bags, please disinfect them. And then some other states have taken kind of a less overt action and have waived the tax they've placed on single-use grocery bags. That was done in an effort to encourage the use of reusable bags for environmental reasons. But at this point, they're really focused on trying to limit the potential ways that this disease could spread. So that was one really interesting one. The other one is that there's a number of laws that have increased the ability to make hand sanitizer. We talked about panic buying earlier, and one of the early panic buying items was hand sanitizer. So you have some states, like I believe Connecticut, that passed an executive order allowing kind of what they called unique manufacturers of hand sanitizer, which by my out-of-state reading sounded like they were going to let distilleries make hand sanitizer the way Dogfish Head Brewing has started making hand sanitizer in Maryland.
Interesting.
So Dogfish Head Brewing has also been making hand sanitizer as a way to increase the supply chain of hand sanitizer. And then some states, in the effort to make hand sanitizer more widely available, have expressly allowed compound pharmacists to make their own hand sanitizer. And for listeners that may not know what a compound pharmacy is or compounding pharmacy, they're not that common, but they are actually pharmacies where the pharmacists are able to mix medicines on the premises and give them out. So they are kind of what you would imagine a more old school pharmacy from, you know, decades ago.
We'll say back in
where
the day.
Where I can get a soda. And,
Yeah, where they could basically had a recipe and made the recipe of the pharmaceutical to give out to the patrons. There are still some of these compounding pharmacies in the nation. So the states that still have them have, for a large part, enabled them to start compounding hand sanitizer.
So did you want to also talk about emergency orders and the upcoming elections?
Done a deep dive recently of... To Trudy's point earlier about each governor has different abilities within the law to, you know, supersede regulations or statutes, finding that I'll give Virginia's the current example that I have. The governor of Virginia doesn't appear to have the ability to supersede statute, which is a problem because a lot of the election law is governed in statute. They have, or we have, a upcoming election, some jurisdictions scheduled in May, some in June, where the governor has the ability to move the election up to 14 days under a declared emergency, but it doesn't appear to have the ability to change the election to like an all vote by mail, like states like Idaho are doing. So I know the Commonwealth and the Board of Elections are really working to figure out some potentially creative lawyering to enable them to run an election in a manner that would appropriately protect the health and safety of the voters. So there's a bit of a conflict.
I think you could make the argument that voting is an essential function.
Yeah.
But again, I agree that the logistics, I mean, getting people to stand 6 feet apart might take up a lot of room, but then you think about going into the voting booth. Are you going to disinfect every time somebody leaves the voting booth? How is that?
Yeah, that's
So there's just a lot of elements to it. I think the consensus from a lot of registrars is that it is easier to promote social distancing in an all vote by mail system, but very few states have the capacity to process an all vote by mail system. And it's really highlighting some interesting processes we have that work great in a normal time frame that are difficult to adjust to a socially distant society.
So speaking of things that are difficult to adjust in our new socially distancing society, comma, let's talk about the criminal justice system.
States are slow to respond to this. Mm-hmm. I think there is the beginnings of a trend for states to help minimize the spread within the criminal justice system. So to back up, the main concern within the criminal justice system is that people in detention, if the disease exposure happens while they're in detention, it's very likely that that is going to have kind of an isolated spread of disease. Mm-hmm. Just because you have a lot of people closely together, very difficult to socially distance within a detention facility. And the ability to have kind of enhanced cleaning measures might also be really limited in some of these facilities. Some states have really tried to work on kind of a front end of the criminal justice system. So for police officers that are encountering people violating the law on the streets, instead of arresting them in all cases for minor offenses, giving them a bench warrant or a ticket to appear for a hearing rather than actually physically detaining them and taking them to the local jail. I think states are starting to take those sorts of measures. The bigger question on the civil liberty side is some states have taken the stance of limiting visitor access for people in longer term detention. And in mm-hmm. some cases, that limitation of access has also been a limitation on a prisoner's counsel. Creates a serious criminal justice concern of a detainee's right to a speedy trial, of a detainee's right to counsel, and really their fundamental right as a person involved in the criminal justice system. And the courts are just a little slow to adapt to kind of new technologies. That's not uncommon in the judicial system. They're
uncommon anywhere.
Yeah.
based on how distance learning is going for a lot of public schools, I would say the adaptation to technology is a challenge in most sectors. Maggie knows this because you have drugged me kicking and screaming into Microsoft Teams. So we're not picking on any sector in particular here.
No sector in particular. It's a particular challenge with the justice system is that we do have a right to a speedy trial constitutionally in the United States. And there are some true concerns of whether this pandemic is going to really hinder a person's right to a speedy trial. Right. So kind of circling back to the beginning of the episode when we talked about whether or not the stay-at-home orders are enforceable and the notion that you could be, in a lot of states, jailed or fined for violating some of these orders, it would be highly ironic to arrest and detain someone for violating a social distancing measure.
Right.
And I don't think there is a benefit to a lot of states to actually detain someone for violating some of these more restrictive emergency orders. And I would hope that a lot of states that if they have individuals that are violating these orders would issue essentially request to come to a hearing rather than physically arrest them and detain them.
And so is that why we're seeing, Maggie, some states talking about and activists and I think largely in a lot of academic circles as well, and other states calling for the release of nonviolent people in detention centers? So some of them are those pre-trial people that you're talking about. Are some of them people who have already had their day in court, but they are at higher risk and they're nonviolent? I think I remember reading that there was a call to release some of those people that are in detention centers as well.
So I think that another issue in the broader criminal justice reform movement for those individuals that are already serving a sentence after being found guilty of a crime or pleading guilty of a crime are in a detention facility, but the majority of those individuals are not convicted of violent crime. So this bleeds into the kind of concern of we have a lot of people that have been incarcerated for nonviolent offenses such as marijuana possession or possession of other that are not a physical threat to society. And there is a kind of ongoing conversation of whether or not it is useful or a reasonable thing to do to have those individuals detained at all for that length of time. You think back to the 1990s and a lot of these mandatory minimums for drug sentencing, there are a lot of individuals that are serving very long sentences for crimes that in some states now would not even be have an individual arrested for on the state level. So I think there is a movement to highlight the need to have some of these offenders released. And it is just particularly concerning to advocates that on top of what they see as an injustice of them being detained for some of these crimes for so long to begin with, that they're also exposed to a public health concern and at a higher risk while being continually detained.
Maggie sort of touched on consumer protections and protecting the economy with some of these emergency orders, but I know that in many states there are orders specifically prohibiting evictions and foreclosures during this time.
So a lot of states have really looked at both sides of the economic concerns. It's not just the business owners being able to maintain their businesses and their employees. It's also the employees that are now really concerned about meeting their basic needs. We know that there are a number of areas in the country where there is difficulty in accessing and continuing to have housing. So some of the states have really stepped up and proactively addressed this concern by using their emergency power to either delay eviction and foreclosure proceedings, prohibit those proceedings. In some cases, they've also taken the step of prohibiting the ability to for utility providers to turn off service for non-payment. So things like water, gas, electricity, in some states expressly the internet. And they're really looking at both ends to make sure that both the businesses can maintain operations, but also that the employees and individual people are not irreparably harmed for their own fundamental basic needs as part of the response to this pandemic.
So Maggie, where can listeners find more information about this, all of these orders? I know you've done a lot of work, so it'd be great to get that out to people.
So we actually
likewise
have,
want to do deep dives into these intricacies.
Other nerds, welcome.
Yes.
So on the CHHS website, which is mdchhs.com, we have posted a publicly available list of the survey of all of the 50 states plus the District of Columbia of what we have looked at. So in the survey, you will see the jurisdiction, their emergency declaration, both when it went into effect for this pandemic and when it is going to terminate or the conditions in which it would terminate. Whether the state has a stay-at-home order, the status of the public schools, closure of non-essential businesses, limitations on public gatherings, as well as some examples of efforts to address medical surge and treatment, the supply chain, public benefits, and consumer protection. So that survey is available through our website. We are updating it every couple of days. The date of when it was last updated, you can see at the top. Been trying to get it as real time as possible, but the governors are not all on the same schedule for these orders, even though I will say they tend to be clustered on Mondays and Fridays.
So I think that's going to wrap it up for us. We really want to thank Maggie for joining us, for her passion about emergency declarations and her willingness to make spreadsheets and for talking to us about this, because it's clear you've done a lot of research out there. Stay tuned for our next episode, and in between, stay safe.